Section 2, Slavery and Wealth. As you read, look for the miserable journeys of slaves from their African villages to South Carolina, the nature of slavery in America, and particularly in South Carolina, slave culture, family life, and language, the methods and consequences of slave resistance, how rice and indigo production with slave labor led to wealth for the white population. Terms: Middle Passage, Chattel, Artisan, Gullah, Stono Rebellion, Manumission, Driver. So much land, so little labor. That was a problem that many American colonists faced. There appeared to be a limitless amount of land in America, but not enough hands to make it productive. The answer for many colonists was to import slaves from Africa. Carolinians had brought the idea and the system from Barbados. Slave labor made South Carolina the richest of the 13 British colonies in America. Slaves from Africa. The slaves who came to South Carolina were first captured in their native African villages, ripped away from their families and neighbors by other Africans, and sold to European or American traders. They were crammed into crowded ships with hundreds of other frightened and miserable captives. They did not know where they were going or why. They did not understand the language of the ship's crews or even of most of the other captives. Can you imagine the despair, anger, fear, and other emotions they must have felt? The Middle Passage, the slaves' voyage across the Atlantic, the middle part of their journey, was the horrible introduction to their new life. Conditions on the ships were so crowded and dirty that about 1 in 7 of the captives did not survive the voyage. Some, in their hopelessness, committed suicide. After 4 to 8 weeks on the ship, slaves who came to South Carolina were landed on Sullivan's Island and quarantined, kept separate, for 10 days to make sure they were free of diseases. Then they were taken to a slave auction in Charlestown. You can stand in the city today where they stood and imagine the scene of slave buyers examining the merchandise. They poked and prodded the men, women, and children, opened their mouths, and looked beneath their clothing. After purchase, some of the slaves remained with masters in Charlestown, but most were taken to the rice plantations on the coast between Beaufort and the Waccamaw Neck near Georgetown. The nature of American slavery. Slavery has existed in many societies throughout human history. In most times and places, slaves were people captured in wars. The captives were not usually held in slavery for the remainder of their lives. Their children were not automatically slaves. They were not considered chattel, property like furniture or cattle. The slavery that developed in America was different. The slaves were almost always slaves for life. The condition of slavery was inherited. That is, the children of slave mothers were automatically slaves. In American slavery, the slaves were indeed considered chattel. They had almost no rights. No rights to travel or assemble without the owner's permission. No rights to legally marry or keep their own children. White owners were not supposed to kill or seriously abuse their slaves, and it was not in their financial interest to do so. But the owners had few legal restraints on the treatment of their slaves. Another unique feature of American slavery was racial. Almost all slaves were black people from Africa. This fact introduced a tradition of racism that has enormously influenced American life. Black slavery existed in all 13 colonies. All the colonies, and England, of course, profited from the hard work of slaves in the rice fields of South Carolina and the tobacco plantations of the Chesapeake Bay region. In the 18th century, almost all whites looked upon slavery as natural and necessary, with the exception of Quakers and a few other small church denominations. Slavery in South Carolina. More slaves were brought into South Carolina than to any other place on the continent of North America. In the 1730s, black slaves outnumbered whites 2 to 1 in the colony. According to a Swiss newcomer in 1737, Carolina looks more like a Negro country than a country settled by white people. Even in Charlestown itself, half the population was enslaved. Urban slaves. In the urban setting, slaves were mainly artisans, persons who practiced a trade or handicraft, and household servants. The artisans worked as bricklayers, blacksmiths, goldsmiths creating jewelry, and coopers making barrels for shipping rice. They also worked as carpenters and made wheels, boats, wagons, and carriages. Both male and female slaves created coiled, woven baskets and pottery as they had in Africa. They established standards of excellence to which local artists still aspire. Usually the slave owners in the city hired their slaves out to other people to perform these tasks, with the owners getting the wages. The urban slaves tended to have a few more freedoms and choices than plantation slaves. Plantation slaves. Most of the slaves brought into Charlestown were taken out to the rice plantations up and down the coast. On the plantation, slaves were housed in small cabins built by the slaves themselves and reflecting some African influences. These cabins were often clustered in small settlements away from the owner's big house. Within their settlements, the slaves took charge of their own lives as much as they could. They established patterns of life based on traditions from Africa and conditions placed on them by whites. They developed strong family ties, meaningful religious practices, significant art forms, and ways of coping with the system of slavery. Slave communication. The slaves were mingling with many different African peoples, languages, and cultural traditions. This required them to talk to and learn from one another, and they had to communicate with the planter and white overseers. The mixture of sounds on any one plantation might have been very confusing, but humans are creative. The slaves began to develop a pidgin language, a language that included parts of several different languages that allowed them to talk to one another and to the English-speaking whites. Over the decades, the pidgin language developed into a genuine new language that we call Gullah. The Gullah language has a vocabulary taken primarily from English, while the grammar largely adapted from African patterns and rules. At one time, many people thought Gullah was simply incorrect English. Eventually, people recognized that it was a separate, new Creole language, one developed out of several others, that grew out of many African languages and English. A mixing bowl of cultures. New cultural patterns developed, with influences by Africans, Europeans, and Native Americans. Each of these cultures reshaped the others and contributed to a unique South Carolina culture. Yet each group maintained enough of its own identity that it could be identified within the mixing bowl, like the individual parts of a good bowl of salad. Slave punishment and resistance. All this creative development took place on plantations where the labor system was based on raw force. Public display of punishment was considered necessary for proper control of the black population. Forms of punishment included whipping, the most common form, confinement in a small, hot shack, branding, ear cropping, and other forms of mutilation, and execution. Perhaps the worst punishment of all was being sold away from one's family. In spite of, or perhaps because of, the harsh punishments, slaves found ways to resist their masters. Resistance ranged from hardly noticeable gestures or comments all the way up to murder. Slowing down the pace of work, breaking tools, poisoning, and arson, illegal burning of property, were useful means of resisting. More radical and dangerous methods were physical attacks on white persons. Running away was another form of resistance. Many tried it, not many succeeded. some runaways made their way to Florida and were welcomed and taken into the Seminole Nation. But it was just as likely that an Indian tribe would kill the slave or return him to the white government. When runaways were returned, the punishment was severe. The Stono Rebellion. The most serious form of resistance, and the one most feared by whites, was organized rebellion by the slaves. During the 1720s and 1730s, the fear of being overwhelmed by superior numbers was in every white mind. Rumors of many plots kept whites on edge, and blacks with perhaps some sense of hope. In August 1739, the General Assembly required all white men attending Sunday church services to carry their guns. On September 9, 1739, a group of slaves on the Stono River, about 20 miles outside Charlestown, made their strike for freedom on a Sunday morning. Before dawn, about 20 slaves, led by a man named Jimmy, attacked a local store at Stono Bridge and took guns and ammunition. Now armed, the band headed on foot in the general direction of St. Augustine and the protection of the Spaniards. As the rebels marched, they damaged and burned several houses, usually killing their inhabitants. They added new slaves to their ranks as they proceeded. An air of jubilation and confidence developed as they gained momentum. They raised a flag and marched to the sound of drums. They shouted liberty, likely in several African languages. An accidental meeting foiled their triumphal advance. The rebels met a group of five white men on horseback, including the acting governor, William Bull. The men rode rapidly away, alerted the countryside, and gathered a large armed force. The rebel slave band had grown to perhaps 100 by the late afternoon when the whites attacked, killing many, capturing some, and scattering others. The rebellion was smashed. In all, over 20 whites and over 40 slaves had lost their lives. The Stono Rebellion was the largest and most significant slave uprising in South Carolina history. It was a pivotal moment for slaves. The white response to the rebellion shut off any realistic hope for freedom. The revolt unified the whites and enabled them to take new steps to make their system of slavery work more safely for them. That was both good and bad news for slaves. Tougher slave laws. The good news was that laws were passed to discourage slave owners from treating their slaves brutally. White leaders recognized that this behavior by some owners could lead to rebellion. The bad news for slaves was that new laws in 1740 required owners to control their slaves more tightly. They could not teach their slaves to read or write. They had to restrict slaves' ability to move about and to settle. Slave patrols were increased, with armed white men assigned to ride at night to make sure slaves were not engaging in illegal activities. Owners could no longer set a slave free as a reward for some great service, a process known as manumission. Only the General Assembly could do that. The rice fields. By far the largest number of slaves labored in the rice fields. They brought with them from certain parts of West Africa the technical knowledge for rice production. They already knew how to plant the rice, flood and drain the fields at the correct times, harvest the grain, and prepare it for use. The knowledge and hard labor of the slaves produced the Carolina gold that enriched the planter class and made South Carolina prosperous. On rice plantations, labor was organized into tasks. In the task system, each slave, man, woman, and child above age 5 or 6, was assigned a daily workload. When the job was done, the slave had free time for the remainder of the day to rest, tend a garden, or catch fish for the evening meal. This system encouraged slaves to work hard and well so they could have some time for themselves. The work was assigned by white overseers or by black drivers. slaves who were selected for their ability to control other slaves. Rice production boomed during the 18th century. Exports were more than 30 million pounds annually by 1740. By 1770, exports were more than 66 million pounds per year. Upon this production, most of the wealth of South Carolina depended, but not all. The deerskin and fur trade were still important, as was the production of lumber and naval stores. And in the 1740s, a new staple crop emerged to complement the rice culture, indigo. Indigo. The cultivation of indigo, a plant that produced a beautiful blue dye, was not new in South Carolina, but it wasn't widely grown until the 1740s. The sudden rise of indigo as a significant factor in the colony's economy had two causes. One was the work of Eliza Lucas Pinckney. The other was a British subsidy offered for each pound of indigo produced in the colonies. Under the policy of mercantilism, the Parliament was trying to avoid buying indigo outside the British Empire by encouraging production within the empire. By 1747, South Carolina exported 138,000 pounds of indigo dye. In 1775, the colony exported over 1 million pounds. Beaufort and Georgetown, the second and third oldest towns in the colony, became the centers of indigo-growing regions. Indigo was a perfect complement to rice cultivation because the two crops needed different types of soil. The wealth of South Carolina. The wealth of South Carolina was based very largely on the labor and skills of slaves. Because of slaves, rice, indigo, naval stores, and skins and furs, South Carolina had a larger percentage of wealthy families than any other North American colony. Of the richest 10 men in the 13 British colonies at the end of the colonial era, 9 lived in South Carolina. The richest was Peter Manigault, a planter of Goose Creek near Charlestown. At that time, how a person got his wealth was not considered particularly important. Slave traders Henry Lawrence and Miles Bruton were as respected as any rice or indigo planters. Do you remember? 1. Define in sentence form, Middle Passage, Chattel, Stono Rebellion. 2. What sorts of jobs did urban slaves who were artisans have? 3. What technical knowledge of West African slaves helped in rice production? 4.